This is disc number 5.
Wait here, Lawrence whispered. No, I'm coming with you. Lawrence tapped his boot. I've got crampons, you don't. Want to end up like Jared? Abigail watched her father work his way down. Isaiah smiled when he saw him coming, said, Larry, you must have cantaloupe-sized nuts. You'd have made a hell of a soldier, because that jumping off the cliff shit was pure badass. Where's your gun? The strap's twisted around behind my back. I can't reach it without slipping. Lawrence squatted down by Isaiah's head, jammed his left crampon into the ice. I was thinking, Larry. Want to call it square?
No, Lawrence, Abigail said.
Man, I just want to get the fuck off this mountain, home to my family, you understand?
Give me your hand, Lawrence said.
As he reached up, Lawrence stomped his right crampon onto Isaiah's left shoulder. Isaiah's boots lost their purchase, and he slipped down the ice along the same path Jared had blazed, making no effort to self-arrest, just staring upslope, his eyes never leaving Lawrence.
You better hope this fucking kills me, he said, and disappeared over the edge.
41. Abigail gripped her father's arm as they traversed the mountain, moving at a crawl on a 50-degree slope, Lawrence taking his time to thrust the teeth of his crampons deep into the ice, since they bore the weight of two.
I would have liked to have seen their bodies, Abigail said, just to be sure.
Yeah, but way too risky to edge up to the cliff and look over. We might have joined them. Trust me, they're either dead or wishing they were. They pushed on, Lawrence's dimming headlamp doing little to guide their way. After a while, he stopped. They'd left the steepest stretch of ice several hundred feet back.
This isn't good, he said. We should have run into our old tracks by now. I was hoping to follow them back into the canyon. That's the only safe way down.
They went on, Abigail covering her face with the hood of her moonstone jacket. Unsettled by the disturbing numbness that had begun to diffuse through her cheek from a patch of burning cold under her left eye. Every step sparked a needle of white-hot pain that shot from the tip of her tailbone up into her throat. She'd begun to cry when Lawrence said,
Thank God.
Abigail looked up. Through blowing snow, she glimpsed a two-story building perched on the edge of a cliff.
What is that place? She asked. Are we back at the mine?
No. We're 1,000 feet above it. That's the ruins of the Godsend's upper boarding house. 40 men used to live up here, so they'd have easy access to the mine's upper reaches where all the richest ore deposits were located. Otha Wallace lived here.
So is it good that we found it, or?
It means I at least know where we are, and I can get us down to the canyon floor from here. Come on, let's get out of the storm. The exterior of the boarding house stood in dire disrepair. The wood spongy and soft, the porch overgrown with moss, animals having gnawed partway through the support beams. The ground floor was bisected into two rooms by a hall that linked the front door to the back porch. The west door frame opened into the kitchen and dining hall, its floor rotted through. All that remained were a couple of cook stoves, 4 benches, a barrel, and the remnants of a screened cage where the food had been stored to keep it safe from rodents. Abigail and Lawrence picked their way through the debris of a fallen staircase and turned into the living room. The furniture, rustic handmade pieces, still survived, and aside from a hole in the northeast corner, the flooring was largely intact. As they collapsed before a stone fireplace in the back corner, Abigail said,
I think I have frostbite on my face.
Lawrence removed his pack, got up again, limped over to a table in the middle of the room, its surface gray with age, still encased in bark.
You didn't see me do this, he said,
then lifted one of the chairs and smashed it over the table. He carried an armload of broken wood to the fireplace and went to work arranging it on the rusted grate. From the emergency kit in his pack, he took a bar of trioxane compressed fuel and a plastic matchbox.
This may catch the whole place on fire, he warned.
Lawrence struck a match, held it to the fuel. Soon the fire starter glowed and then the old wood began to pop and hiss, flames licking up between the stones for the first time in more than 100 years. Abigail scooted up to the edge of the hearth and extended her hands toward the warmth.
Thank you, she said.
Her father had taken off his parka, and he inspected her face by firelight.
Is it bad? She asked.
It's just the top layer of skin that's frostbitten. You may always be sensitive to cold, but no serious damage. That gash above your eye looks worse than anything.
Abigail stared into the flames, shadows playing on the warped board floor, the raw, unfinished walls. The accumulation of everything was pressing down on her, a meltdown coming, though she knew she didn't have the luxury of falling apart just yet.
What's upstairs? She asked.
Just a big room with a stove in the middle and 20 built-in wooden bunks.
A pile of rat-chewed paper lay in a stack near the hearth. Abigail picked up an old catalog, thumbed through the brittle pages. She saw an advertisement for a wedding dress with a checkmark by it, wondered if the miner had ever gotten home to marry his love, or if he'd disappeared with the rest of Abandon. She noticed some writing on the nearest wall.
Who would come up here and defile this place?
That's not vandalism, Abby.
Lawrence crawled over and shone his light on the tiny scrawl.
Some of the miners wrote this. You can tell because it was done with pencil, and the handwriting isn't like ours. It's very small and fine, almost like calligraphy.
Abigail, too sore, too warm to move closer, said,
What's it say?
Well, this is just a column of numbers. Over here, someone wrote, John owes Bill $2. Below that one, this is hell.
What's that drawing a couple feet above your head?
Lawrence stood.
How lovely. I haven't seen this one. It's a miner's Nelly. Someone sketched a woman's face. You see a lot of these in boarding houses since the men were so lonely up here. Abby?
He looked back at her.
I had no idea he was going to kill Emmett. I know you didn't. But you and Scott did drag us all into this shit. You did do that.
Look, the real reason I contacted you wasn't for this stupid ghost hunt. It was for the gold. The plan was to locate it on this trip, maybe take a few bars out with us, come back later for the rest. I wanted to share finding it with you.
So you just used Emmett and June for their backcountry pass?
You have no idea how hard it is to get legal access to this Fox Canyon. And they needed a guide anyway. Abby, I was going to take care of you, of your mother.
The time we needed you passed a lot of years ago.
I know.
Lawrence sat down beside his daughter.
What did your mother think of your coming out here to see me?
Furious at first that you'd, after all this time. I tried to make her see it wasn't a betrayal, just something I needed to do.
May I share something with you?
He unlaced his boots, removed his wet socks, propped his bare feet on the hearth.
I was having my morning coffee the day you arrived in Durango, and I had this vision. At least, I think that's what it was. I was a few years older, a little slower, a little whiter. Through some unexpected windfall, I was living in a vast mansion up in the mountains north of town. The house had been built in an aspen grove near a river. It was early June, and around midday there was a knock at the front door. I walked through the foyer with a big grin on my face because I knew who it was. I was expecting them. This beautiful family stood on my doorstep. My daughter, her husband, their two kids, Molly and Larry. My daughter and I.
Lawrence cleared the emotion from his throat, spoke more softly as he continued.
We embraced. Nothing held back. I shook hands with her husband, and he called me Dad. My two grandchildren ran inside and tackled me to the floor. See, this family had come to stay for a while. They had a whole wing of the mansion to themselves, and it was one of those perfect Colorado summers. I taught Larry to fly fish in the river, and Molly loved to swim, so some days it was just the two of us, and I'd take her pool jumping at Cascade Creek, swimming at Haviland. In July, when the wildflowers peaked, we all hiked up to Engineer Meadow, and the flowers were more spectacular than they'd been in years. I showed my grandchildren how to identify the blooms. We even picked a bouquet for their mother. The evenings were best. After the kids had gone down, we'd have dinner on the back porch. Candles, wine, lots of laughter, watching the alpenglow fade out of the needles. And then came the stars, and you couldn't believe how many there were. And there was no bad history, no pain, and, Abby,
You looked at me across the table like I was someone you loved. I came out of this vision or dream, whatever you want to call it, overcome by a devastating emptiness, a sense of total loss. I've lived alone in Durango in a two-bedroom Victorian on 3rd Avenue, going on 20 years now. I don't have close friends. There are acquaintances, a brother I talk to on the phone once a year on Christmas morning. Occasional dates, but no real love life. My work's been my life and love. I've demanded absolute freedom, lived on my terms, and I'm just now, at 52 years old, beginning to understand what the price of my freedom is. And it's this. I'll never have a summer like that one I imagined a few days ago.
The fire roared now, its heat thawing Abigail's face, causing an itchy burn in her left cheek.
Lawrence, she said, that's a real sad story. But there's something you're missing, and maybe if you figured it out, you might be on your way to changing some things.
What am I missing, Abby?
She looked at his purple right eye, the line of dried blood cracking down his cheek like old plaster.
It's still all about you, what you lost, what you won't ever get to experience. It's about you getting old, feeling empty. I was 4 when you left, and I didn't hear from you again until you wrote me about this trip. Not on birthdays, not on Christmas. Do you know I believed I'd done something to make you leave us? That it was somehow my fault?
Abby, you have to know that,
and that in some deep and broken part of me, I still believe that. You left us. Mom never married. Practically holed herself up in that house for years, thinking you'd come back. Maybe if I'd had a brother or a sister, it wouldn't have been so god-awful lonely. When I got into Columbia, you know she had to come to New York with me? 'Cause I couldn't leave her in Baltimore. 'Cause she had nothing. No one. I didn't spend college in a dorm. I lived with my mother in a tiny Brooklyn apartment, through 2 suicide attempts, 3 commitments, every second spent studying or working so we could eat, so we'd have heat in the winter. Waking up middle of the night sometimes, hearing her talking in the dark as I stood at her door, realizing it was you she was talking to. Like you were lying in bed with her, like you loved her, even speaking for you. Do you know what that's like? To hear your mother reenacting the first time you two met? Fantasizing about a man who'd left her 20 years ago. Look, Mom's better now, and I'm a big girl, got my own life. This isn't about me crying for the daddy I never had, but I wish you could have been there with me, just one of those nights, seen what you turned her into.
Lawrence drew back. He got up and walked over to the empty window frame. Several rocking chairs creaked out on the back porch, pushed by the wind. Lawrence looked back at his daughter. Abigail stared up at her father. She wanted to see his face streaked with firelit tears, wanted to catch just a glimmer of self-loathing or shame in her father's eyes, though it wouldn't have changed much, but it might have been a start. Lawrence had gone hard. He scowled, as if deeply offended, and in the light of the flames, his face appeared faintly grotesque and very old. 1893. 42. Otha Wallace walked into the saloon without bothering to shed his oilskin slicker or knock the snow from his stovepipe boots, tracking great clumps of ice and powder as he crossed the board floor. Lana Hartman sat at the piano, working quietly through the first movement of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. The young deputy still snored in drunken bliss beside the stove, wrapped in a bearskin robe, a spittoon between his legs.
First rattle of the box with some irrigation, Otha said.
Joss set up a tumbler and a glass of beer as he reached the bar.
What are you doing here?
She whispered.
Thought you wasn't coming back till tomorrow.
There was a big goddamn spoke in the wheel.
What?
Unexpected company up at the saw blade. We was followed by Ezekiel Curtis and that doctor.
Russ Ilg?
Didn't catch the man's name, but we had quite a scrape. Billy shot them both, and that makes 7 dead in less than a day. We need to quit the flats right now while the gate's open.
Joss took out her makings, rolled a cigarette, pulled a punk from her prayer book. Just a sulfur-tipped splinter of wood. She lifted her shirt, struck the match against the middle button of her canvas trousers, then lit the Quirly, smoke ascending into the bleary light of the kerosene lamp above the bar. Otha took up the glass and drank, chased it.
"He's fair sobered," Joss whispered, motioning to the deputy. "Wasn't going to get him really stewed till tomorrow, like we discussed."
"You got that big bowie under the bar? One you almost shoved through my ear this morning?"
Joss grinned, blew a stream of smoke into his face.
"That should get the job done."
"What about?"
Joss cocked her head toward Lana.
"You ain't got all attached to that she stuff, have you?"
"You ain't touching her, Oath. Let me just send her on home."
"Fine."
"What about Billy?"
"What about him?"
"He coming with us?"
"Sure he's coming. Gonna try to straighten that bulky bitch of his out first."
"And if she don't straighten?"
"Well, she knows, and he knows, that won't stand."
"You reckon that scrub will kill his wife, just like that?"
"I think you might be surprised."
"I'm still gonna be the one to deal with him for going rough on old Bart. You ain't forgot that, have you?"
"Jesus Christ, Kinky, cut the boy some.
You ain't got all attached to your pard, have you?"
"No, but Billy done all right today. Ain't no scissor bill. Boy's got some sand. Killed both those men up there like it weren't nothing. Shined. And he's paying a visit to their wives as we speak."
"And I give a solitary shit why?"
"Look, we need his help getting out of town, loading up everything at the pass, driving the burros down the other side. You can dobe-wall him in the tall timber before we get to Silverton. Don't you worry those pretty black eyes."
"Condescend to me one more time."
"Christ, you're in a sod-pawn mood."
"And what if his wife and kid come along?"
"Well, I guess they won't see Silverton neither."
"I want no part of killing that girl."
"Then you'll have no part of it. Pour me another." "Oh, fuck it. Just give me the bottle."
Joss pushed it forward and Otha thumbed off the cork, swallowing two mouthfuls.
"I gotta say," Otha said when he'd finished, "I'm consternated about the future of our association."
"And why's that?"
Joss took back the bottle and drank.
"You know I love you, so don't go getting your underpinnings in a big fucking knot when I say this."
"What, goddammit?"
"You're a little smoky. Men tend to buck out around you."
Joss smiled, whiskey running down her chin.
"What you think? I'm gonna make you come, Oath?"
"It's a reasonable concern, all things considered."
"Only thing to get you killed by me is trying to get me unshucked and in the willows. I see the way you look at me sometimes."
"Think I want up in the snatch of a mestiza?"
"Right. Was it a hard climb up to the pass?"
"Well, no holiday."
"Why the fuck didn't we do this in the summertime?"
"'Cause you gonna be doing the strangulation jig down in Arizona. Go on, tell Lana to get."
"Lana?"
Joss yelled over the piano. Lana stopped playing, stared down at her lap.
"Lana, honey, I want you to go on home for the day. We gonna be closing up early. You ain't done nothing wrong. Your playing was real pretty."
Lana got up from the piano bench, walked to the coat rack, and slipped into her wool-lined cape, pulling the hood over her head.
"Lana?"
Joss said. The young woman stopped in the doorway, her back to the bar, head hung low.
"You take care now, okay?"
Lana went outside. When the door closed, Joss pulled the bowie out of its sheath, set the knife on the bar. She and Otha looked over at the deputy, who was still snoring quietly.
"The key to your shackles is..."
"On that big metal ring on Al's hip."
Otha tilted the bottle, took another long pull. Then he wiped his mouth, picked up the knife, scraped his thumb across the blade.
"I keep it sharp," Joss warned.
Otha sucked a whistle through his teeth and licked the blood from the shallow slice.
"I'll say."
"How you gonna do it?"
"Slip it in between his slabs, then twisty, twisty."
Otha moved soundlessly across the boards. He stopped at the pot-bellied stove, waited for a moment, letting his fingers warm, then stepped over to the deputy's left side, positioning himself so he'd have the best angle for a downward thrust. He opened the bearskin robe, exposing the man's chest. Al's eyes flittered under his lids, and Otha wondered from what dream he was about to awaken. His grip tightened on the handle. As he plunged the blade, he heard something outside, the knife point stopping 3 inches above the man's heart. Otha glanced back at Joss.
"The fuck is that?"
he whispered. He set the knife on the bar, walked to the door, cracked it open. It was late afternoon, the sky clearing, and though the sun had already dipped below the canyon walls, he could see its long rays coppering the distant bladed rock at the pass, 2 miles south and 2,000 feet above. Stephen Cole tore down Main Street, hell for leather through waist-deep snow, his horse kicking up clouds of powder, and the Bible puncher shouting as if the apocalypse were upon them.
"They're coming! They're coming!"
43. Gloria wet the nib of her pen in the inkwell. She sat in a chair built of bent aspen branches and wrote by the light of a shadow gi made from an old can of Towel's log cabin syrup, cut in half and poked full of holes. It hung from a rafter over the beautiful oak table Bart Packer had given them, the candle inside dispensing just enough light for her to write without straining her eyes. When she'd finished, she blew the page dry and left the diary open on the table. Gloria walked to the bedroom doorway. She and Ezekiel had been lucky to find a cabin with a plank floor, and they'd spent a weekend last September laying straw and blue denim over the boards. It wasn't carpet, but it wasn't dirt, and you could walk over it in socks without freezing your toes. Bessie and Harriet slept on the iron bedstead, and watching the mother and child hold each other under the quilt, Gloria felt a flare of envy. She looked at the mail-order rocking chair in the corner by the window, at Gus's crib, which Ezekiel had assembled out of packing crates, some of her dead son's clothes still laid out on the tiny mattress, a burlap sack stuffed with pine boughs. The front porch creaked.
"Zeke!"
Someone banged on the door. Gloria hurried back to the living room, grabbed the Schofield from the bookcase, where she'd left it sitting near a few dime novels.
"Miss Curtis, you in there?"
Gloria edged to the door.
"Need to speak to you straight away."
Her husband's words echoed in her head.
"Don't open it for nobody. Billy or Otha or some rough-looking fella come by, you know what to do."
The door shook. Gloria put her hand on the latch, said,
"What is it, Mr. McCabe?"
"I come for Bessie and Harriet. They in there with you?"
Bessie emerged from the bedroom in her flour sack underpinnings, a blanket wrapped around her shoulders. She mouthed,
"No."
"They aren't here, mister. Now, I don't know if I believe that. How about you open this door and let me take a look for my own self?"
"Now isn't the best time, Mr. McCabe. I'm sure you understand."
"No, Mrs. Curtis, I don't understand. But I'll give you 10 full seconds to open this door before I tear it off its hinges."
Bessie said,
"We ain't coming home with you, Billy."
"Oh, you ain't, huh? Why don't you open this door so we can have a face-to-face conversation like adult human beings?"
Gloria said,
"When Zeke gets home, we'll all talk this out."
"Well, we might be waiting here quite a spell."
Gloria lifted the latch, threw open the door. The barrel of the single-action revolver touched the end of Billy's nose.
"You want to elaborate on what the hell that meant?"
Billy smiled, his jagged teeth showing, but his eyes were skittish. His horse stamped in the snow. Even though his vaquero hat kept his face in shadow, Gloria could see that it was flecked with blood, and her heart fluttered.
"Why don't you go on and put that away? You ain't never shot nobody, you ain't about to."
"You don't know anything about me. Get your hand away from that gun. Where's my husband?"
"He went up to the mine looking for you."
"Well, I guess he didn't find me, did he?"
"You said we might be waiting here quite a spell. What's that mean, you runt? Ain't you man enough to stand by the words that come out of your mouth?"
"You do like I said and put that revolver away."
Gloria thumbed back the hammer. Billy's eyes widened.
"I don't know what's happened to you," Bessie said. "Your mind ain't right. You and Otha kill those people like they say."
"Now ain't the time, Bess. Go on and get Harriet and come on."
"Said I ain't going with you, Billy."
His face went red and the corner of his mouth began to twitch. He turned as if to leave, then suddenly reached back and swiped the revolver out of Gloria's hand, almost like an afterthought, and swung the walnut stalk into her face. Gloria sat down in the cabin doorway, dazed, her nose burning. When she looked up, Bessie was crying in the threshold of the bedroom, blocking her husband's path to Harriet.
"Billy, just leave, please. I'm scared of you, and it—"
"Your hair's falling out 'cause I can't put adequate food on our table. Know what that feels like for a man? They's risks and they's sacrifices in life, yeah? Well, I just made a few big ones, and now we're set like you can't even believe. That dream we talked about before I come out west, remember? Well, it's here. We got it for the taking. Tired of going to bed hungry, and not being able to afford cake soap, or wearing fucking flour sacks for clothes, saving all year just to buy a doll for Harriet. You want a new dress? You can have 20 of them. It'll take our baby girl all day to open her presents next Christmas. We'll go somewhere warm and buy a big house, and abandon won't seem like nothing but a bad dream. Hell, we'll go back to Tennessee if you want. Get your mother, your brothers out of them shacks. Maybe I can take care of Arnold. You think they don't deserve that?"
Gloria struggled to her feet. She felt dizzy, her head swimming, blood and tears running down her chin, staining her white petticoat.
"What about Otha?" Bessie asked. "I don't like that bunco."
"Well, fuck Otha. We'll get our share, leave that son of a bitch in Silverton. Shove out on our own steam. Just you, me, Harriet. And our life could be so good if you can find a way to forget a couple of days of poor behavior. Can you do that, Bess? Then it's all yours. Everything you ever wanted. We'll be a well-heeled pair of bums on the plush. Straight goods."
Gloria had begun to back quietly toward the kitchen. There was a knife inside the small wood box, a medicine chest filled with herbs and tinctures, sitting on one of the newspaper-lined shelves.
"Hey, Daddy,"
Harriet said. The little girl had climbed out of bed, and she stood behind her mother, clinging to Bessie's legs.
"Hey there, darling."
As she reached the kitchen, a board squeaked beneath Gloria, and Billy spun, drew his big walker.
"You do me a great favor and sit down by the fire, Mrs. Curtis."
Billy looked back at his wife.
"You think I'm some monster, Bessie? But I ain't. Just willing to do more for my family than most."
"Billy, you say you've done this for me, but look at my face. What kind of a man beats on his—"
"Won't ever lay a hand on you again. That's a promise. I need to know what all you've done before I—" "And I'll tell you everything. No more secrets. But right now, till we get out of this town, I need you to trust me. I love you and Harriet. You're my blue chips. That's the only reason I've done any of this. Will you trust me?"
Bessie looked over at Gloria.
"Don't look at her. Look in my eyes. This is your crossroads. What do you want?"
"To be with the boy I fell in love with in Tennessee."
"You're looking at him."
"Am I?"
"For a fact. Gonna be different after we leave. So much better."
"I wanna believe that, Billy."
Gloria said,
"Bessie, you didn't see what your husband did to—" "Shut up!"
Billy touched his wife's face, and Gloria saw it happen. A softening in Bessie's eyes, walls coming down.
"Burn the breeze back to the cabin," Billy said. "I want you to pack what food we got. Enough clothes for us to get to Silverton."
"We're going now?"
"Can't stay in this bog hole."
"Bessie," Gloria said,
"what are you doing?"
Bessie reached down and took her daughter's hand.
"I'm sorry," she said. "But he is my husband. I ain't got nothing else."
Gloria's eyes ran over.
"Where's my husband? Where's Zeke?"
The McCabes walked onto the front porch. Billy said,
"Y'all go on. I gotta talk to Miss Curtis alone."
"About what?"
"Gonna trust me or not, Bess?"
As Billy closed the door, Gloria stood up. The fire, nothing more than a few orange coals.
"Is he dead? Will you tell me that before you shoot me down? Is that Zeke's blood on your—" "Oh, God."
She'd noticed his cowhide custom maids.
"You're wearing his boots."
"I can't shoot you, Miss Curtis."
Billy jammed the long barrel of the walker down his pants and pulled a rusted buffalo skinner with a staghorn grip from a sheath under his frock coat.
"Please,"
she said as he came toward her.
"Got no choice here. You sit still and we'll do this quick."
The front door opened. Billy tucked his knife into his coat, looked back over his shoulder.
"I thought I told you.
Something's happening,"
Bessie said.
"Oscar and Randall are riding around yelling for everybody to come outside."
"What for?"
Gloria could hear the shouting now, saw two men on horseback loping up the path toward the cabin.
"Something about Indians. Come on, they're calling for you, Billy. Want you to ride up to the pass with some of the other men. Help head 'em off."
2009. 44. Abigail's watch showed 2:49 a.m. as a sprawling menace of Emerald House appeared through the falling snow. They'd killed their headlamps after leaving the switchbacks, and it had proved exceedingly difficult plowing their way through the basin in the total darkness of the storm. At the lake's edge, 100 yards from the big Douglas fir trunks of the portico, they collapsed in the snow.
"I'm dying here, Lawrence."
"I know, me too."
"I don't think I can walk much farther."
Aside from her heart beating in her ears, the only other sounds were the lake lapping at the bank and the distant drone of wind tearing over the peaks.
"I still think we should just hike back to camp, get my cell, try to—"
"I told you, we won't get service in the canyon."
"But maybe up at the pass."
"In this storm? Are you kidding?"
"Then let's just get the hell out of here, Lawrence. Go for help."
"It's 27 miles back to civilization, and you just said you didn't know if you could walk any farther. In this weather, we wouldn't reach Silverton until Thursday morning at the earliest, and that would be hiking non-stop, hauling ass, assuming we didn't get lost or take a fall climbing down the icy south side of the saw blade. Look, I brought the Tozers out here. Now that Emmett's dead, June's my responsibility, and I'm not leaving her in that mansion with Stu."
"Oh, now you're responsible, when it might get us killed," she thought. "Then what do you want to do?"
she asked. He struggled to his feet, reached down, helped his daughter up out of the snow.
"I want you to follow me and keep quiet."
They stole up to the west wing of Emerald House, and Lawrence boosted Abigail into the same windowsill they'd attempted to escape through several hours earlier. Once inside, she watched her father hoist himself onto the sill, then gave him a hand stepping down into the kitchen on his sprained ankle. Together they slipped through the French doors and eased out into the corridor, just a gaping black hole that made Abigail temporarily forget the awful pain in her tailbone.
"I can't see," Lawrence whispered, "so just go slow and make sure you don't trip on anything. We make the slightest sound, it's over."
"Is the floor safe?"
"Nothing is."
They proceeded with meticulous caution, testing the floorboards with every step to avoid a potentially fatal creak of weak wood. The darkness never let up, and without the aid of headlamps, they had to trail their hands along the wall to ensure a straight trajectory down the corridor. Abigail followed a few feet behind her father, and she kept looking back over her shoulder, plagued by the unrelenting premonition that someone was creeping up behind them. When Lawrence stopped, she said,
"I don't like this. I want to get out of here right now."
"Look."
30 feet ahead, a dim splotch of light shone onto the marble floor of the foyer.
"It's June," he whispered.
In the vicinity of June's headlamp, shapes began to materialize out of the darkness. Abigail could see Emmett's widow sitting on the floor on the other side of the staircase, her back roped to a timber that had fallen out of the ceiling, her hands pinioned, shoulders heaving with grief. Abigail spotted Emmett's body not 10 feet away at the base of the steps. It was impaled on a thick banister. She braced against the image, forced back the bile rising up her throat, made herself move on to the next moment. There was madness in the details, in the lingering. Lawrence whispered,
"Where's Stu?"
Abigail shrugged, quietly unzipped her jacket, and pulled a wallet from an inner pocket. She fished out a dime, knelt down. The coin made a soft and delicate purr as it rolled across the marble, spinning out just a foot from June's right leg. The woman looked up, the bulb of her headlamp making it difficult for Lawrence and Abigail to see her.
"Hurry,"
June whispered.
"He'll be back any minute."
45. They crept across the icy marble of the foyer, and when they reached June, Lawrence withdrew Isaiah's sheathed dagger from his ski pants.
"You okay, sweetie?"
Abigail whispered, her words reverberating through the foyer like prayers in a vast cathedral. It was hard to see June's face with any clarity in the sole fading light of her headlamp.
"My left leg's cut pretty bad," June said, on the brink of tears.
Abigail touched her shoulder as Lawrence sat down and began sawing the knife through the climbing rope that bound June to the rafter.
"How long's Stu been gone?"
Abigail asked.
"About 10 minutes."
"We didn't see any new tracks leaving the mansion."
"No, he's still inside. He heard something up on the third floor, went to check it out."
"What'd he hear?"
"Sounded like wood breaking from down here. It was loud." "What happened to you guys?"
"Isaiah and Jared are dead," Abigail said. Look, I'll tell you that story later. Does Stu still have night vision goggles and a gun?"
"Yes."
Lawrence unwound the climbing rope and tossed it aside.
"Can you stand up and turn around for me? I'll cut these off."
The blade sliced easily through the nylon restraints.
"June, I think it'd be a good idea to switch off your headlamp."
The three stood close together in sheer darkness. After a moment, June spoke, her voice breaking.
"I keep looking over there at him. Keep thinking he'll get up, come over to me, or that any second I'll wake up in our apartment, reach over in bed, feel the warmth of him in the dark. But he's cold now, isn't he? Do you think I could go over and sit with him? Wouldn't that be all?"
"You hear that?" Abigail said.
"What?"
Lawrence asked.
"Listen."
From some remote part of the mansion came a sound like a muted jackhammer, and it took Abigail only a moment to place it.
"Stu's firing his machine gun."
"That doesn't make any sense," Lawrence said. "Scott's back in town, dead. Isaiah and Jared are dead somewhere up near the pass. What the hell's he shooting at?"
The machine gun went quiet. High above in one of the upper corridors came the thump of slow, heavy footsteps. Abigail peered up. They all did. But there was nothing to see in that expansive vacuum of light. She reached down, grabbed hold of June's hand as the footsteps stopped. No one whispered. No one breathed. Something crashed into the floor of the foyer, and Abigail and June nearly crushed each other's hands. They stood in stunned silence, no one daring to move. Lawrence finally turned on his headlamp.
"Dear God," June said.
The light beam traced a widening lake of blood across the floor to its source. The destroyed head of Stu. He lay unnatural and broken on the section of marble exposed to the skylight, his face torqued away from them.
"You think Stu accidentally fell?"
Abigail said.
"Or jumped? Remember what Isaiah said about him, how he'd fallen apart since the war?"
"He drank half a bottle of vodka after you left," June said.
Lawrence shook his head. "Look, his gun's gone. Night goggles, too."
"So, maybe he left them on the third floor."
Lawrence started toward the west wing.
"Wait,"
Abigail whispered. She caught up with him.
"You aren't seriously going up there."
46. Emmett's plunge had effectively destroyed the central staircase, so Lawrence and Abigail worked their way back toward the kitchen to the west wing stairwell. They climbed to the third floor and stood for a second time in that bullet-shredded corridor, Abigail feeling trapped in some kind of repetitive fever dream, coming back again and again to this nightmare world. Their headlamps passed over the doors, the wood-paneled walls, the mounds of snow where the ceiling had failed. Lawrence limped a few steps into the corridor, stood there listening. They proceeded on over the pockmarked wood where Isaiah had fired up at them through the ceiling, skirting that hole where Abigail had punched through and nearly fallen to her death. They reached what was left of the central staircase.
"I don't hear a thing," Abigail whispered.
"Me neither. Look at that."
He pointed to where several dozen brass shell casings had rolled against the wall.
"What was he shooting at?"
They walked on, their headlamps aimed toward the end of the east wing corridor, an occasional snowflake drifting down through the ceiling, a speck of bright white in their light beams.
"Maybe he did jump," Lawrence whispered. "Got fueled up on vodka and freaked out when he heard something. Emerald House shifts constantly. It's full of noises. Or it could have just been an animal, another coyote."
"Should we go back then?"
Abigail said. "Yeah, I think that's a good..." Lawrence took a sharp breath.
What?
Abigail whispered.
You're scaring me, Lawrence.
Something just stepped out from one of the rooms at the end of the corridor. She clutched her father's arm.
Where'd it go?
Toward the sitting room, I think. It was just a shadow, and it moved so fast.
Okay, let's not do this, all right? This is stupid, like in horror movies when people walk into haunted houses by themselves for no good reason. I want to go...
This isn't like that, Abby. Come on. We have to see.
No.
Then go back down to the foyer and wait with June. But I'm not leaving until I... She tightened her grip on his arm, said,
I'm not going anywhere in this place alone.
Then I guess you're coming with me. Lawrence continued slowly down the corridor, Abigail clinging to her father like she was 8 years old again. They came at last to a decimated sitting area at the corridor's end, heard nothing but the wind moaning outside in low, dissonant tones like some demonic choir. Snow billowed in through the window frames, having already buried the bookshelves and even drifted into the fireplace. As Abigail swept her headlamp over the ravaged furniture, the listing chandelier began to tinkle. Lawrence was already turning to go back, but before following him, she shone her headlamp into the far left corner.
Jesus Christ!
What?
Lawrence!
A man crouched behind a rat-eaten divan, his knees drawn into his chest, rocking slowly back and forth and shivering with cold.
Are you with them?
He whispered. And Abigail felt so completely paralyzed that her knees gave out and she sank onto the floor, trembling with pure fear, adrenaline raging, heart redlining, even before she saw Stu's machine gun in his hand. 1893. 47. Molly Madsen sat in the bay window, eating the wedge of chocolate cake from the Curtis's Christmas basket, and looking down at the commotion on Main Street. It had been years since she'd seen this many people out on the town at once, entire families webbing north through deep snow, many still buttoning their slickers and coats and pulling on their mittens, a ubiquitous look of fear and confusion on all the faces. Molly heard footsteps out in the hallway, followed by a soft knock. She rose from the divan, crossed the room barefooted, and opened the door. A young blonde woman stood in the hallway, enveloped in a white woolen cape.
May I help you? Molly asked.
Lana noticed that under the sheer bed linen, draped like a shawl over her shoulders, Molly was naked. On many occasions, Lana had glimpsed her sitting in the bay window from the street below and thought her pretty. In proximity, Molly Madsen looked hard-wintered, pupils dilated from laudanum. Her 5-year self-imposed confinement to room 6 had turned her skin the sun-deficient gray of a dead tooth. And though her pitch-black hair dropped to her waist, you could see her scalp on top, where her hair had thinned and become laced with silver. Seam squirrels, lice, crawled under the hair on her arms. The room reeked worse than a bunkhouse. Spoiled food, oranges, a hint of old perfume.
You're the piano player, Molly said.
And when she smiled, Lana saw her lips smeared with chocolate icing and bits of cake stuck between her rotting teeth.
Jack and I have so enjoyed sitting in the window listening. The music carries quite well. It's a sure cure for putting me to sleep. Was that Beethoven you were playing this afternoon?
Lana reached into her cape, pulled out a pencil. She stared at the tan-colored wood of the doorframe, trying to conjure words that had for so long existed only in the safety of thought. She couldn't remember the last time she'd written anything, but it was easier to recall the letters than to amass the nerve to create them. With no words spoken, no direct communication with another human being in 3 years since that Christmas night in Santa Fe.
Molly said, "Can't you talk?"
Lana looked up, forced herself to make eye contact. Her gloved hands trembled as she pressed the pencil tip into the wood. When she'd finished, Molly scanned the tiny writing on the doorframe, said,
"It's Angler. Mrs. Jack Angler. Why on earth would I come with you?"
Lana scrawled an answer. Overwhelmingly strange to converse with another person, even like this. The piano had been her larynx for so long. "Something awful happening." Molly read it, said,
"Well, I can't leave yet. Jack should be here any moment, and what would he do if I was gone when he returned? I have to be here to greet him. You understand?"
A draft wafted through the hallway, blew open Molly's shawl, her nipples erect in the chill. Lana wrote, "Leave note."
What if he didn't find it? He'd be distressed if I wasn't here. Jack's very protective. No, I think I'll wait in our suite. But thank you for the invitation. We'll come along when he arrives. Where is the ball being held?
Lana shook her head, eyes welling up with tears.
You know, I have the perfect dress for it. A rose-colored evening gown. Jack first saw me in it in San Francisco. Knew instantly he had to have me. Would you care to see an album in print of my husband? You've never seen a more handsome man, I assure.
Lana tried to grab her arm, to pull her out into the hall, but Molly withdrew into her suite and slammed the door. 48. Lana refastened her webs in the lobby of the deserted hotel and went outside. The sky was a rusty red. The walls of the Box Canyon slathered in alpenglow. Sounds of men shouting resounded through abandon. She waded out into the middle of the street where a path had been beaten down in the snow, fell in behind a young family of four, followed them down Main, listening to the children complain of the cold, begging to go home so they could finish supper and play with their Christmas toys. Glancing up a side street, Lana saw more people streaming out of the cabins, and someone yelled, "Hostiles!" They passed the burned-out buildings on the north end of town, torched over a year ago in an autumn fire. The family ahead of her stopped. The father knelt down, drew his children into his arms.
"Why are you crying, Pa?"
"Ain't." But he wiped his eyes. "Gotta leave y'all for a spell."
"Where you going?"
"Me and some of the other paws are gonna ride up toward the pass and stop what's coming. Make sure don't nothing happen to this town and all the maws and children in it. But I'll be back for you know it. Need you to listen to your maw for me."
"Yes, Pa. Yes, Pa."
He stood and embraced his wife, and as Lana bypassed them in the deeper snow, she heard the woman say,
"I'm scared, John."
"Don't be, love. Just pray."
The web tracks branched off from Main and went up the hillside. Lana passed smoking cabins on the spruce-dotted slope, saw two Italians on horseback rousing families from their Christmas suppers, hollering for them to get dressed quick and head up to the chapel. The church stood in the distance, one of the first buildings erected in abandon, though after a decade of scant upkeep, it needed whitewashing, and the windows on the north side had been boarded up since a blizzard had blown them out in the winter of 1890. A crowd was gathering on the steps, and as Lana looked up at the wood cross, black against the copper sky, it began to teeter, and she startled. Thought for half a second the world was ending. Then the iron bell began to clang, faster and faster, and she saw the preacher, Stephen Cole, pulling the tolling rope, not with the leisurely announcement of a wedding or a Sunday service, but with all the ominous urgency of a warning, so hard that it shook the belfry and made the cross stand crooked. 2009. 49. He reached into his parka, pulled out a lighter and a pack of cools.
"You want a smoke? That menthol shit?" "Of course." "What the hell?"
Isaiah slipped two cigarettes between his lips, lit them both, handed one to Jared.
"Ain't this some shit?"
They sat perched on a 4-foot ledge midway down the icy headwall.
"You got the first aid kit in your pack?"
Jared asked, his voice straining with pain.
"Nah, it's in one of the duffel bags back at the mansion." "Fuck. Hurts bad, huh?" "Holy shit, man. A little morphine would really hit the spot." "It looks bad." "I haven't looked." "No? Well, you can see the bone." "Shut the fuck up. I don't want to hear that."
It was snowing so hard, Isaiah had to cup the end of his cigarette to keep the ember dry. Jared took an aggressive drag, leaned back against the rock he'd slammed into feet first on his fall down the mountain. Both legs were stretched out, but the right one had rotated almost 90 degrees, so at a passing glance he appeared to own a pair of left legs.
"You think Lawrence is lying?" Jared asked. "Did it first. Now I'm not so sure. I think he may be just as pissed as we are."
"So no gold?"
"Nada."
Fuck, this hurts, man. Talk to me. I gotta keep my mind off it. What were you gonna do? Say we actually found it, managed to get the gold out of these mountains. So, say it turned out to be 24 mil, right? That's 8 apiece. Well, first off, I'm in debt over 200,000. I was gonna pay that shit off, put enough aside to send the kids through school, set me and Sherry up so we didn't have to work. Then after that, say I got 4 mil left to play around with. We were gonna build this tight palace, man, in one of those upper-class, all-black suburbs of Atlanta. We already sketched the design. Shit. Home theater, exercise room, huge master bedroom, 12-foot ceilings, big pool, jacuzzi, basketball court, giant grill out back. Kind of place my kids would want to come back to after they were grown and gone. Christmas or Thanksgiving, it'd be me and Sherry, our 3 kids, about 100 grandbabies running around. I'd have liked that. Sherry knows what you're doing out here? Me and Sherry, we synced, man. No secrets. That's the only way. She's my partner in all things. So how about you? Any big plans for your share? Jared tossed his cigarette over the ledge and groaned. Come on, baby. You gotta keep talking. Chase that pain away. You've seen worse. No, actually, we have a winner. Jared closed his eyes, tucked his gloved hands into his armpits, shivering violently. I didn't even need 8 million, he said. You'd have stayed in Colorado? No, I was going to head up to Alaska, last frontier, right? Find some land out in the middle of bumfuck, where there wasn't even a road in. You Daniel Boone motherfucker, you. Maybe in the Chigmits, the Aleutians, put a cabin on a big lake. Always wanted to get my pilot's license. I'd buy a little float plane, and the only time I'd ever leave would be to go for supplies. Just live out there and fish and hunt. Forget about all the shit I've seen. Not hear that. Nobody'd ever see my ass again. Jared gritted his teeth. I never been so cold, man. Think Stu would have got his shit together with his share? I think he'd have just drunk himself to death faster and with better booze. Damn, man, this is getting worse and worse. Isaiah flicked his cigarette away. He stood up, peered over the ledge, staring down into roiling snow and bottomless dark. How's it look? Jared asked. Steep as shit. Can't even tell how much farther it goes down. We got a situation here. That we do, brother. You aren't hurt bad, are you? Just my head and my pride, but they hurt like a motherfucker. You foresee any way of getting me out of here? Isaiah sat down, put his hand on Jared's shoulder, shook his head. Jared nodded. Afraid you might say that. Just don't know how we'd explain our way out of this one, partner. I'm sorry. I fucked that jump up. Jared wiped his eyes. You ain't gotta apologize for shit. A catch in Isaiah's voice, too. Jared said, Look, if it's gotta be this way, I can't just sit up here by myself waiting to freeze to death. Not in this kind of pain. You know what I'm saying? I feel you. There's no other way. You sure? I don't see it. Isaiah pursed his lips together and cocked his head, his brow furrowing up as his eyes welled. Serving with you, man, he said. I know, same here. Let's just get this the fuck over with, huh? Isaiah took up his machine pistol and racked the slide. His eyes burned. He couldn't see. Had to wait a moment, letting them clear, not wanting to fuck any part of this up. You want to pray or something, Jared? Wouldn't know what the fuck to say. Haven't prayed a day out of my whole life. God ain't a fool if he's up there, and I don't want to insult the man, particularly now. Anything you want me to take care of when I get out of here? Anybody you want me to go see? Let them know, give them a message, or... Like who? I don't know, your parents. He smiled. Your harem of bitches. Nah, nobody'll notice. You ready, then? Jared drew in a deep breath, looked all around at the rock, the snow, the darkness, the cliffs, taking heed of this cold ledge where he was going to die. Yeah. Love you, brother. Never said that to a... You too, man. You too. Family, you know? Yeah. Well, the suspense is killing me, so... Jared turned away. He stared at the tip of his boot. Thought how pretty the snow was falling on it,
and what a strange last thought this was. Isaiah raised the machine pistol, positioned the barrel a few inches from the back of Jared's head. He calmed himself, held the red dot steady. Jared slumped over into the snow. Isaiah fired another cool, sat for a while smoking, listening to the wind, watching snow pile up on the rock on Jared. For the moment, it melted on his friend's warm face. At length, Isaiah stood up, but he felt empty, something unfinished. He had a notepad in his backpack, and he pulled it out and found a pencil. Sat hunched over the paper, shielding it from the snow, he scribbled down 5 words, tore out the sheet of paper, and slipped it into the pocket of Jared's parka. Isaiah gathered up his things, then followed the ledge for 30 feet until it slimmed out into nothing. As he began the slow and treacherous descent into the canyon, he kept thinking of what he'd written for his friend, wished it could have been more, repeating Jared's epitaph in his head like a plain song. This man was a soldier. This man was a soldier. 50. The man behind the divan stood up, the machine pistol quivering in his grasp. There was a flash, Abigail thinking he'd pulled the trigger, the walls of the sitting area lighting up, the snow glinting. It went dark again. Muffled thunder rolled through the basin, shook the chandelier, the weakened floor trembling beneath her feet. Abigail rose up slowly, her arms outstretched in deference to the weapon. When the lightning came again, she noticed the streaks of blood down the man's face, his eyes rimmed with black bruises. "Are you with them?" he whispered again.
"With who?" Abigail asked.
"The men in masks. They were... Get back!" he yelled, and Abigail saw the machine pistol shift to her father. Lawrence said, "You see my hands, right? I promise you we aren't a threat. In fact, we're probably in the same... I'll decide that." His eyes returned to Abigail. "What are you doing here?"
"We arrived in Abandon this afternoon, a team of 6. Downstairs in the foyer is the 3rd remaining member of our party. Tonight, while we were exploring the town, those men in masks took us hostage. They killed our guide and a man named Emmett."
"Tell me the names of the men who attacked you." Abigail had to think for a moment, her mind edging into overdrive.
"Isaiah, Stu, and Jared. Jared was also one of our guides on the hike in, but they're dead now."
"All?"
"Yes."
"How'd the other two die?"
"Isaiah and Jared fell off a cliff near the pass a couple hours ago."
"What were you doing up there in the storm?"
Abigail hesitated only a second or two. "Looking for these gold bars. Did you kill Stu?"
The man nodded slowly.
"What happened to you?" Abigail said. "Your face.
Is it bad?"
"Yeah.
You two look pretty banged up yourselves." The man lowered the machine pistol. He stepped out from behind the divan, walked into the beam of her headlamp, tall and very thin, though even through the bruises he had gentle eyes, which Abigail instinctively trusted. His silver and black down coat appeared to have been ripped through the middle by a knife swipe, and his stringy brown hair lay pasted with sweat to the sides of his face.
"I'm Quinn," he said.
"Abigail."
Though it was difficult to tell with all the bruising, she placed his age around 40. Her father stepped forward.
"Lawrence."
"Lawrence Kendall?"
"Have we met?"
Quinn smiled.
"No, but I'm an admirer of your work."
"What are you talking about?"
"I've been in the history department at the U of A Tucson last 7 years. This ghost town's been my passion for a long time."
"Thought I was the only one. What's your last name?"
"Collins."
"Haven't heard of you."
"I've only published in my field, Colonial America and the Revolutionary War. Abandon's more like a hobby, I guess."
"Last great mystery of the West."
"Absolutely. But I just got tenure this year, so I'm hoping to get funding and support for a semester of real study. Maybe even a grant to come here for a summer."
"Good luck getting a permit for that."
"Yeah. My attitude's been, fuck the Forest Service. I've been coming up from Arizona every year to spend time in this canyon. You'll do a little elk hunting on the side, but it's a real thrill to meet you, Lawrence."
Quinn reached out to shake his hand. "I've read everything you've written on Abandon." 51. They came upon June at the base of the steps, She was standing by her husband, one hand on the banister that had run through him, the other caressing his shaved head.
"Just us, June," Abigail said.
She glanced up at them, void of expression, catatonic.
"Who's that with you?"
she asked.
"This is Quinn. He was being held here by Isaiah and Stu."
Quinn froze when he saw Emmett, brought his hand to his mouth, whispered,
"Oh, God! June, is it? I'm so sorry. Is there anything?"
"No, there isn't. I just need to be alone with him."
Abigail touched her arm, said,
"Maybe you should..."
"No! Go!" They left June with her husband and sat down nearby on the cascading staircase that flowed toward the large oak doors. Abigail pulled three water bottles out of Lawrence's pack and rolled two of them across the floor to Quinn.
"Thank you."
Quinn unscrewed the cap and ravenously downed the entire 12 ounces in one long gulp. Then he leaned back against the steps and gingerly ran his fingers across his face as if reading Braille, trying to picture how the damage had distorted it.
"Isaiah did that?"
Abigail asked. "Quite a violent streak in that man."
"So what exactly happened to you?"
Quinn opened the second bottle of water and took another long drink. "I arrived in Abandon last Wednesday morning. Wednesday night, very late, I woke to the sound of footsteps near my tent. Frightened me pretty bad. I called out, asked who was there. No one answered. Of course, I couldn't go back to sleep, so I unzipped the tent and crawled outside. There were two men in masks with guns standing there." He shivered, as if just speaking about it rekindled the fear. "Isaiah and Stu brought me to this mansion. They kept demanding that I show them where it was. I told them I had no idea what they were talking about. They said I was lying. They beat me, tied me up, and left me in one of the rooms on the third floor. Several times a day they'd come back, ask if I wanted to tell them or if I needed another beating. I would always say the same thing. I didn't know what it was they wanted. Tonight, after working me over for a while, they blindfolded me and slapped a piece of tape on my mouth. A few hours later, I heard a ruckus on the floor below and voices I hadn't heard before. Suppose that was you guys. I managed to find an edge on the old chair they'd strapped me to, finally cut through the tape around my wrists about an hour ago."
"You made all that racket up there that caught Stu's attention?"
Abigail asked. "Yeah. I'd crept downstairs, seeing there was only one of them guarding June, and I knew it was my only chance. When Stu came up, he was drunk, and I managed to overpower him." Quinn sipped his water. Outside, the wind still made that strange, unnerving sound like ghosts humming.
"So why'd you come to Abandon in the first place?" Lawrence asked.
Quinn smiled. "Well, why are you here?" Abigail sensed something in the current between the two men. Lawrence said,
"I was giving June and her husband a tour of the ghost town. They're paranormal photographers."
"That's all, huh?" Abigail realized what it was. Distrust. These two historians sizing each other up, attempting to gauge how much the other one knew, what to let on, what to keep to themselves. "What was it again you were looking for up at the pass? I think I heard Abigail say something about..."
"All right, should we quit jerking each other off here?" Lawrence said. "Anyone who studied Abandon in depth knows that a sizable quantity of Packer's gold has never been accounted for."
"And you've been searching for it?" It got quiet for a moment. Then Lawrence said,
"Yeah, and you?"
Quinn nodded. "You an honest man, Lawrence?"
"Guess that depends."
"What if I were to tell you that I have something in my jacket that might be able to help us out?"
"I'd be interested."
"Interested enough for full disclosure?"
"Assuming it cuts both ways."
Quinn reached into his pocket, handed Lawrence a rusted key attached to a nylon rope.
"Where'd you get this?"
Lawrence asked. "Full disclosure?"
"Yeah."
"From an old man on his deathbed?"
"What's it open?" Abigail asked.
"I spent the last 10 autumns of my life trying to find an answer to that. I know it doesn't open anything in this crumbling mansion or the ghost town or the mill." Lawrence got up, limped over to the entrance of Emerald House, threw the doors open, stood watching the snow. Abigail called out,
"You all right?"
After a moment, he returned, stared down at them, and Abigail could hear the change in his voice as soon as he opened his mouth.
"There's almost 2 feet of snow on the ground," he said. "I know it's late, and we're all past the point of exhaustion.
But with the snow dumping like this, an avalanche would make it impossible to find. We'd have to wait until next summer, when the snows broke. Besides, it's not safe to be in Emerald House with all this snow piling up on the roof. Quinn stood up, said,
I don't understand. What are you getting at?
I might know what your key opens. 1893. 52. Under calmer circumstances, Gloria might have noticed the sky. Clouds striated with a thousand tones of orange, like you were staring up into the guts of an overripe peach, and some of them still bleeding pink curtains of snow. But she couldn't see anything through the window of tears. Someone yelled her name. Gloria stopped, turned back, looking downslope at the chapel far below, the clang of its bell echoing through the canyon. The last of Abandon's residents trudged up the web trail, the closest of them Emma Ilg, wrapped in a black manta, her purple gown bulging out of the bottom, encrusted with ice. Emma stopped below Gloria and hunched over to catch her breath in the thin air. When she looked up, she said,
Have you seen Russ?
What's wrong? Gloria shook her head, tears streaming. Billy McCabe and Otha Wallace. Know 'em?
Know of 'em? Why?
Gloria went to pieces.
I think they killed our husbands.
Emma's ruddy face turned cold, rigid.
No, don't you say that to me. Russ and Ezekiel are up ahead. They're trying to find us. Listen to me, Emma. I will not hear. Billy and Otha murdered Mr. Packer last night and made off with his gold. That's why our husbands rode up to the pass. But it's been 4 hours and Zeke hasn't come back to me. How do you know they're gone? 'Cause Billy came to my cabin and was on the verge of killing me before.
You seen them dead?
No.
Then they aren't. My husband's up ahead.
Please, Emma,
don't speak another word to me.
Emma pushed her way up the trail, knocking Gloria down into the snow as she passed.
A ways up the mountain, a woman screamed.
Al, get your fucking hands off me, Joss said.
Come on, there's children up ahead of you. Watch that mouth.
Don't tell me how to be. You got these wrist irons too tight. They're strangulating my hands, and I need a brain tablet.
I'll fix them when we get there and you get a smoke. Simmer down.
Joss glanced up toward the end of the canyon. With the storm having passed, she could finally see the steep white slope 2 miles south that led up to the saw blade. She squinted her eyes, trying to raise the black specks zigzagging down like a line of warrior ants. Thought she'd rather go it alone, take her chances in Abandon, than hold up with this miserable bunch of pilgrims. Near the rim rock, the trail had become an icy staircase, stomped down and smoothed over by the passage of 100 pairs of webs.
How you expect me to climb with no hands?
All in your neck. I'm helping you, ain't I?
Joss purposely tripped, and Al had to grab her under both elbows to keep her from sliding down the mountain.
We're almost there, he said. Can you climb 10 more steps?
As Joss struggled to her feet, her fingers grazed over the bowie knife jammed down into her canvas trousers, and she thought,
It will be such a pleasure to stick this in you, you stackwad cocksucker.
50 feet back down the trail, Joss heard a woman scream.
Where's Daddy?
He rode up to the pass with Mr. Wallace, honey.
What for?
Don't you worry about that.
Bessie walked ahead of her daughter as they climbed the slope above town, her mind running in 10 directions at once. The gold, the murders, heathens riding down from the pass. They'd been delayed in getting to the chapel because Billy had told them to go home first and pack for the trip to Silverton. But she was with him now, and despite everything, it felt right. He was her husband, after all. The good Lord commanded that she obey him. The trail steepened, and just ahead lay a series of icy steps that climbed the remaining distance up the Questra to the rim rock.
All right, Hare, I need to hold your hand on this part.
Bessie turned around.
Harriet?
She screamed.
Harriet!
She couldn't see anything downslope, standing high enough above town that a slice of the sun still lingered over the far side of the canyon.
What's wrong, ma'am?
An Englishman leading his wife and 2 daughters stopped on the trail just below.
You seen my daughter?
She's yay high, 6 years old, curly black hair. She was right here with me not a second ago.
No, I sure haven't seen.
Oh, Jesus, excuse me.
Bessie tried to scoot by, but the big bearded Englishman stretched his arm out to stop her.
Ma'am, now you gotta keep climbing. We're in terrible... I've lost my daughter.
And someone's gonna find her, and they'll bring her along.
Sir, please step out of my way.
You're holding up the line.
Harriet! Harriet!
As Bessie tried once more to step around him, he scooped her up, threw her over his shoulder, and continued up the steps toward the rim rock, Bessie flailing and screaming, the Englishman shushing her.
We're gonna get everyone safely inside, and if she isn't there, I'll go find her myself. That's a promise.
But Bessie's desperate screaming drowned him out. She even surpassed the church bell until the mountain swallowed her. 2009. 53.
June whimpered. I should have stayed with Emmett. He's all alone in that place.
Abigail walked with her arm around June, supporting her, and within earshot of the two professors.
I know, she said, but we can't split up, and with the snow coming down like this, the roof of Emerald House could collapse.
They made a careful descent out of Emerald Basin, down the steep switchbacks to the canyon floor, Lawrence and Quinn talking shop while they fought their way through the snow. Even though her tailbone was in agony, Abigail felt revived by a second wind as they passed their buried tents, the llamas standing together in a mass of fur and breath clouds. It was almost 4 a.m. when they entered the ghost town of Abandon, a pride of headlamps moving between the dark and snow-fraught buildings, some swaying in the wind, on the brink of collapse. She caught a fragment of what Lawrence was saying.
Tempting, but my first priority is getting June and my daughter out of here.
As they approached the north end of Abandon, Abigail improved her pace, came up between the professors, said,
So where are you taking us, Lawrence?
He glanced back.
Not much farther now. All will be revealed.
At the end of town, Lawrence turned and led them up the east side of the canyon. After 100 yards, Abigail's headlamp shone on something through the heavy snow. That ruined church in the spruce, its iron bell capped with snow, its cross powder blown and listing in the wind. They hiked on, the snow rising almost to her knees. Soon they were climbing again, Abigail using her hands and feet now, the slope so steep that she had to kick her boots in to avoid slipping. At the moment she didn't think she could climb any more, Lawrence reached back and pulled her and June up onto a wide ledge. They'd arrived at the base of the rim rock. From here the canyon wall rose vertically into darkness, and Abigail was on the verge of asking where they could possibly go from here when she saw it. Behind Quinn, an opening to a mine shaft, 7 feet high and wide enough for several to walk abreast into the mountain.
How have I never seen this? Quinn said.
Lawrence pointed to the rock around the opening.
Because of the way the rock overhangs, you can't see the shadow of the tunnel from the canyon floor. You'd have to stumble upon it by sheer dumb luck, like I did last year.
He turned and walked into the mine.
Warmer in here, Quinn said.
Most of the mines around Abandon stay a balmy 37 degrees Fahrenheit year-round, refreshing in the summer.
Abigail and June followed them in. The wind died away.
How's your ankle holding up, Lawrence?
Abigail asked.
Doesn't matter. I'm on pure adrenaline now.
Water dripped from the ceiling onto the hood of Abigail's jacket. The air smelled dank of water and minerals.
This is the end of disc number 5. Please insert disc number 6.